My name is Vonna Pertel.
Tell me a little bit about your decision to adopt. What led to it, and how did you decide on China?
My husband and I had been married for a few years. We're unable to have children. We had went through the fertility process with treatments and IVF, had miscarried. And for me, I thought that was it. I thought we weren't able to have kids. We weren't going to have kids. But my husband was actually the one who said, why don't we look into adoption? And so we looked into actually the Dave Thomas Foundation. My husband, for whatever reason, knew that Dave Thomas had been adopted. And there was a Dave Thomas Wendy's Foundation, I think, with adoption, and had told me to look into that. And so I went ahead and got the information. And we went here locally in San Antonio to an information session and went in with the mindset of looking at domestic adoption, a private domestic adoption. And so we went to that process, just kind of getting some information. And while we were there, they also touched on international adoption. We realized how, to us, scary domestic adoption would be. We heard stories of people who, they had couples there who had actually went through the process several times. And what we didn't realize was that, you know, a birth mother has so many days after she gives birth to change her mind. And these people had actually had that happen to them several times. After everything we had been through, I knew that was something I couldn't go through. So we started listening, kind of tuned in more to the international adoptions in the different countries. And once we heard about the little girls from China, that just seemed like to be the one that we wanted to look into. Before that, we had also looked at going through the foster system and had inquired about that. I made one phone call. I mean, that was as far as I went, was I made one phone call, talked to what I'm going to guess was an overworked social worker who said, you do realize that 90% of the kids in the Texas foster system are biracial. He had no idea who I was on the other end of the phone. And that didn't sit well with me. But then he also said that, you know, you could foster a child for several years. And if it is determined that that child goes up for adoption, that that child doesn't necessarily end up with you. They could end up with another family who's higher on the list. And so just based off of that one conversation, we didn't pursue it. But after we went through, it was Methodist Mission Home here in San Antonio that we had went to an information session at, we decided we wanted to look more into China and go that route. So that's what we ended up doing.
Why didn't that social worker's comment about children being biracial sit well with you?
I am half Filipino and half American, or Caucasian. And to us, either one of us, it didn't really matter what the race of a child was. You know, just the same as one of my children has special needs or was considered special needs. Had we had a child through natural, you know, traditional ways, I wouldn't have been able to guarantee 100% that that child was going to be, you know, a healthy baby with no complications or anything like that, which is the same reason why we, you know, didn't have a problem with special needs. But as far as biracial went, it doesn't matter to us. It never did. I mean, I didn't grow up. I grew up in a military family. So we traveled a lot. We were around different ethnicities and everything. Whereas my husband, it was a little bit different. Where he's from, it's everybody's Caucasian. I mean, they maybe had one black student in their school, you know, where he grew up at. But when he went off to college, you know, he had roommates that were from Africa and other places, other countries. And so it didn't bother him either. So, yeah.
So it felt like the social worker was kind of warning you about something you didn't feel the need to be warned about.
Right. I think the social worker probably, you know, has probably encountered numerous times. I mean, a social worker for the state, I guess they've seen all kinds of things. But probably one of their biggest battles may be someone who they're thinking in their mind. Again, he never met me, so he doesn't know who we are. But probably thinking, oh, you know, somebody who's coming along saying, oh, I want to adopt a child, but, you know, I want a healthy white child, you know, and everything. That's what I'm looking for. And maybe it's harder for them to place children that are biracial. But I mean, in this country, I mean, that everybody's something, whether they want to admit it or not. So, you know, yeah. So it didn't, it probably sat poorly with me that was a big deal to him to mention it to me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So then you kind of zeroed in on China. What was it about China as opposed to the other international options that appealed to you?
We seem to fit all of the criteria for China. You know, they went through with the different countries what some of the criteria was. China seemed to be the one that we fit the most. And then when we heard about how they treated, we may have been one of the only people who weren't aware of what the problem in China was with the one child policy and the girls and what they did. I was very naive to that until we started the process and started learning about it. But I thought, both of us thought, wow, that's where we want to go to. The only thing that kind of turned us off was that we were pretty much told it's going to be a girl. We didn't care either way if it was a boy or a girl, but the whole idea that a girl was probably going to be the only option, we were kind of like, I don't know. But, and China also seemed to have the most streamlined process and the safest process. We had met people who had gone through Eastern Europe and adopted and had run into a lot of problems. We knew one family who actually had a child, went to go meet them once or twice, and when they went back to finalize everything, had been told that they had to come up with some more cash, and the whole adoption ended up falling through. So we knew that China seemed to have the most stable program, which felt really safe to us. So, yeah.
So when you started to find out about the one-child policy, did that make you want to adopt from China more? In other words, did it make it more appealing or less appealing? Or what kind of, how did it play into your thinking?
For me, I don't think it mattered either way. I couldn't believe that they were still practicing the one-child policy. And didn't really have an understanding until we started looking into it deeper about the lengths that people would go through in order to keep that boy that they wanted. And I just couldn't believe that they would actually, you know, do something to a little girl or an unborn child that they thought might be a girl. And so that part, you know, made us want even more to be able to, you know, go through with the process and hopefully come home with the child. So.
And what year did you adopt the twins? When did you start the process and when did you come home with them?
We started the process in 2005. I was probably a little overzealous. We started in May of 2005. Our dossier left for China in November of 2005. And we came home in October of 2007 with them. So when we had started, we first meeting with the social worker was 6 months, 9 at the most, you'll have your baby in your hands. And then after our dossier left, the slowdown started occurring. And so what we thought was never going to happen, it eventually did happen, you know, 2 years later. And I'll never forget the phone call that we got in August that said, and I can't remember the specifics, but I remember that our adoption agency is actually in Minnesota, and they had a bridge collapse or some sort in, St. Paul, I think it was. And so that had halted mail service and everything. And our dossier, we had heard, or our referral package had landed. So we couldn't get our referral package, but we knew it was in the United States. So our agency had said, look, we have another office in an, you know, close by. They've received all our mail, but we haven't, you know, where our people were working on our stuff. Whereat they hadn't received it yet. And I'm like, we had waited so long. Yeah. I'm like, somebody needs to find. So I was the person on the phone like every couple of hours. Did somebody find it? And they finally found it. And they called us. I think it was like 48 hours after everything had actually made it in that they were able to call us. And they called us. And I'll never forget. Our social worker here was the one who called us. And she said, are you sitting down? And I said, well, wait a second, I got to get my husband. And so we were both at work because I was working for him at the time. And she said, you have been referred twins. And so, yeah, so we had no idea.
Had you said you were willing to take twins?
We did. So we had, when we initially sent our dossier, our I-700, I think it was approved for two children. But we had only made the formal request in all our paperwork for one child to China. But then in May of 2007, we knew that our referral date was coming up, that our login date was coming up. And so we had reached out to our agency and said, hey, we would like to see if there's any possibility of sending a letter to China requesting specifically twins. And so they said, well, we can do that for you. However, it's not going to happen. It's really rare. Don't get your hopes up. But if you really want us to, we can do that. But you have to do some things on your end. So we had to reach out to my husband's employer and have them write some letters and get a couple of other things together for them. And we submitted a whole new package together that they forwarded on. When we got our, they said, we've sent it. It's gone. We'll see what happens. And then in August, we got the phone call and said we have twins.
So it wasn't a whole new dossier, but it was kind of an addendum to the dossier.
Yes. Yes. We had to submit a bunch of new financial paperwork to them. I think that was very important for them to see what we, things had changed for us after that length of a wait. And so we had to show some new financial stuff to them. My husband's employer had to write another letter to them. And then the agency wrote a letter and then they sent it off. And so we just sat and we waited and we got the phone call, and it was an interesting phone call because we got the phone call that you have twins. There was a but. But one of them has a red marking on her hand, and they thought it was a hemangioma, but they weren't sure. But it was very important to the doctors there and the officials in China that we understood what we were getting. And so my response to that was, well, is it hurting her? What do we need to do? Are there doctors who can see her? What needs to happen? And they said, well, they want to make sure that you go through all the steps that you need to with your doctors there to review her file and everything before you accept the referral that you want her. And so I couldn't imagine not taking her because she had a red hand, but it was obviously a big thing to them. And it was an even bigger thing when we went for our medical visit. So, yeah, so it was a big thing to them.
So a hemangioma is just basically a birthmark, isn't that right?
It's a birthmark. And so after coming home with Kai, our third one, we learned that it was just blood vessels that hadn't broken up in utero. And so the plastic surgeon was like, by the time she's 6 or 7, it's going to be gone. You won't even know it was there. And she had a swollen thumb, you know, just because of it and everything. And surely by the time she was 4, it was almost unnoticeable. So, but for us, it was a way we could tell them apart because they're identical.
which daughter was it?
Zoe.
It was Zoe. Okay. Yeah. So, and has it eased? Is it still there? Is it gone?
It's gone.
Wow. So you learned a little bit about Chinese culture and general approach to quote unquote a disability or an abnormality.
Right. Yeah. It was, unbelievable to me that they, I mean, the lengths that they went to stress what we needed to do to make sure that we were going to accept this referral was just mind-blowing to me. But it is a difference in culture. So, you know, I will tell you now, we've had them home for, what, 7 years now? The moment that the referral acceptance and everything got to us in San Antonio, I met the paperwork at DHL and was ready to sign it.
So tell me about your decision to go back and adopt your son.
So that, again, is my husband. It was, we were getting ready for the girls' 1 year post-placement visit. And my husband said, I want to go back. And I said, you're crazy. And so we talked about it and said, okay, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it now, because we didn't want a huge age difference between them and everything. And thought, what better way to start than, you know, with a 1 year post-placement, get everything started to go again. And so we reached out to our social worker again and said, look, this is what we're interested in doing. So she got us all the information. Some things had changed, you know, with our government on how we filed paperwork and how they had to write up the home study and everything. And so we sat down, met with her and said, this is what we want to do. And we were going to go the normal process. We were ready to just dive in for the normal process, figuring 2-3 years is what we'd be looking at. And then she informed us that it was a 5-year wait. And we thought, oh, we don't think we could do that. So she said, this is another option. Our agency, we were going to go through our agency in Minnesota. We had had a really good experience with them. And they said, this is what we're doing with the special needs list, if you're interested. And so theirs was pretty much a list would come up at midnight throughout the month. They would go through and match. They would match families with who they thought, you know, based on, you know, the information sheet on what they could handle and things like that, that they had checked off. And so we said, okay, let's go for it. So that's what we did. So the girls, we had their post-placement done in October. And the biggest thing that took was rewriting the home study numerous times. And then our paperwork was actually getting ready to go to our agency. And they called me and said, we think we have a match for you. Do you have your paperwork done? And so I said, okay. And so they gave us 24 hours and I said, our paperwork's on the way. So by the time we get back to you, you'll have everything. And so that was in June. And by December, we had went to go pick him up.
And what year was this?
2009. So yeah, 2009.
So you knew you were going to be doing a cleft repair.
Yes.
Was that daunting at all or?
No, not in choosing it. We were fortunate enough to get a hold of a doctor that we knew through someone who was practicing here in San Antonio. And when we had considered cleft lip, cleft palate, I reached out to several different doctors and he was the only one who actually spent like 2 hours on the phone with me one evening, just explaining to me what to expect about cleft lip, cleft palate. And that sometimes cleft lip, cleft palate just isn't cleft lip, cleft palate, that it could be a symptom of something else, of a bigger syndrome, but that we needed to be aware of that. But, you know, he said, if it's just a classic case, it's just a matter of repairing and that's it. And so, you know, he kind of laid everything out for us, but made us feel very comfortable and was willing to do whatever we needed him to do when we got ready to bring that child home. So.
And Kai said he's had 12 surgeries. Is he right about that?
That's pretty close. It might be a little more.
How many of those were any of those in China before he came home?
No, they were all done here. So he was unrepaired when we got him. And so you mentioned about the culture and the difference. When we went to pick him up, we ran into quite a number of people who stopped us and said, you must be Americans if you're taking him. We hear there's a really good cure. So I tell everybody that story because it just, it just goes to show that they think it's a disease, and that there's some magical cure. And so I tell them, everyone that we encountered, I took as an opportunity to educate them and tell them that it's not a disease. It's a matter of just, you know, going in and a couple of surgeries to repair it. And, you know, he's had some complications here and there. And so he's probably had to have more than, you know, the average, but, you know, it's on the whole, it's an easy fix. Yeah. So
tell me about his ear.
Oh, so he has, they call what they were referring to as slight microtia. What microtia is actually where you don't have an ear hole, but you have the form of the ear, but not an ear hole. But he actually had the ear holes where he could actually hear. But because of his ears were slightly deformed. One of them flopped the whole way over. As he got bigger, it became more noticeable. The same with the other ear. And so it got to the point where 2 years ago, it had bugged him so badly that we started talking to the plastic surgeon about it. They didn't want to do anything until he had gotten much older. But he was getting teased and it became more of a self, he was more aware of it. And so, you know, the doctor said his ears are fully grown if this is what he wants to do. And so that was a decision that he made. It was probably one of the roughest surgeries we've been through, because there was a lot that he wasn't expecting. Afterwards, he's my guy that he goes through a surgery. When we prepare, we watch videos on YouTube. So he's well aware of exactly what the doctor's going to do, how they're going to do it, what's going to be used. And so we watched a couple of otoplasties. And so he understood how they were going to cut him and everything. But when we went through the pre-surgery appointments, he was told by one of the nurses that he would be bandaged, completely bandaged. And then when we arrived for surgery, the doctor said, no, I think he's going to heal a lot better if we don't put any bandages on or anything like that, a lot quicker and everything. And so we said, okay. And I really didn't think anything of it. And then it was an in and out thing. And so my husband went to go get the car. I took him to the bathroom because he said he had to use the restroom. And he saw himself in the mirror for the first time. So the girls had to stay the night at a friend's house for 2 nights because he didn't want them to come home. So we respected that. I mean, that was his thing. It was his one surgery that no one could come to the house and see him. He wouldn't let any visitors or anything like that. And so until he was comfortable. So.
And how old was he at this point?
So he was 5.
Wow, he's kind of an incredible kid.
He is. He is. He's probably one of the bravest kids that I know. He's so smart. We've had tons of discussions on why he has to have all these surgeries. Because every year, as he gets older, I think it gets a little bit harder. You know, when it was younger, you were more concentrating on him not touching things and things like that. He didn't understand what was happening. So you were more concerned about, you know, keeping the stitches nice and that kind of thing, him hurting himself. As he's gotten older, it's become more of a self-awareness thing. And, you know, why am I having to miss school? How come I talk different? How come I look a little different? You know, those sorts of things. But I say he has an old soul because he accepts everything that you tell him. He thinks about it. He has more compassion for other people than his sisters do. So he is a good kid.
So the how many of these surgeries were cleft and how many of them were ear?
Only one's been ear.
So he had about 11 surgeries for the cleft.
He's had several lip repairs done. Only because after his first lip repair, we noticed a fine line that started to appear. And we were told that that was a subcutaneous cleft, which meant it was a cleft through the muscle, not necessarily through the skin. So they had to go in and repair that. Then they had to go in and fine tune some things with his nose because the cleft went through his nose. He's had three surgeries. So he had his palate repaired. And then he had to go in and have a pharyngeal flap surgery done. That's where his throat doesn't completely close off to make certain sounds. And 2 years ago, he had to have a second repair of that done. And so he, or actually last year, it was last year he had to have that repair done, because sound, air was still escaping. So he's had to have that done. Cleft lip, cleft palate kids tend to have a little more things that happen with them. He had a branchial cleft fistula in his neck. So that's his neck surgery that he was talking about. He had a hole in his neck and it was a microscopic hole. But when he was a toddler, we had noticed one day we were giving him a bath and all of a sudden this stuff started coming out of his skin in his neck. And we were told, oh, that happens. Don't worry about it. But it became, it was one of those things where he was like, he wanted to go to school and when it would start to drain, if he had a sinus infection or something, it was almost like mucus that would come out of his neck. And so he wouldn't want to go to school. He'd want a Band-Aid put over it. And things like that. So we went to the doctor and we said, look, we got to do something because the kid is, it's affecting him socially. And you know, kids are making fun of him and everything. And so the doctors were, you know, very understanding. And so they went ahead and fixed that. So yeah, so he's had quite a bit.
So this is, it's sort of more of a ride than maybe you initially realized when you thought, oh, cleft lip, cleft palate, that's, by American standards, that's a fairly easy fix, as right. you initially thought. What's it been like to sort of realize that it's actually been quite complicated?
We were well aware of what we were getting ourselves into. Maybe not necessarily the number of surgeries that he's had so far. We were not expecting that. He's got a lot more to go. He has to have some bone grafting done and some other things done, which will be coming up. I think the important thing is getting a team of doctors behind you first and getting all the information, which is what we were fortunate enough to have had, that kind of prepared us for the fact that it wasn't something that was just going to be fixed in one surgery and be done. Sometimes it happens that way, sometimes it doesn't. So to have known that ahead of time has made things a lot easier. The doctor that we had actually had put us in touch with a family who had given birth to a child who had cleft lip and cleft palate. And the woman, it had caught them off guard that this had happened to them. And I remember one conversation I had with her. She could not believe that we chose our son because they were just devastated by, this was their first child, and they were just devastated by what they were going to have to encounter, and the struggles in the beginning. And, you know, I explained to her, I said, if it was, you know, if we had conceived naturally, I wouldn't have any guarantee that it couldn't happen to us. So, you know, we didn't go out choosing him thinking, oh, you know, everybody's going to look at us and think of us as wonderful people that we've saved this poor child. You know, it was one of those things that you just don't know and it didn't matter to us. So, yeah.
Tell me about the dynamic among the three of them, because the girls are twins, so they have a kind of twin thing, and he's younger, yeah. But he seems like he can hold his own. What's that been like?
He does. He I'm surprised he didn't share with you how much he badly wants a little brother.
I'll ask him.
He wants a brother so bad. He keeps telling me, why can't you just go to China and get one like you got me? And we keep trying to explain to him that it doesn't work that way. And that at this point, our family is complete. We have the five of them. So there are times where he sees that bond that is evident between the two girls. And he wants that so badly to share that. And so the girls have, Grace is my one, she's nothing really bothers her. So she was very accepting of the fact that he was coming in. You know, they were three at the time when we brought him home. You know, Zoe, I'm surprised she didn't share with you that she, one of her earliest memories is how she pushed him down the steps and said, send him back. I don't want him. She tends to share that with quite a few people at the most inopportune times. But yeah, I mean, they were, we took them to China with us. They were very excited. But at the same time, it rocked their world. They were the center of our universe for a little over a year. And then all of a sudden, this new baby came in, and this baby who wasn't just a baby, but he was a baby who could take things from them and required a whole lot more attention than they needed or a newborn would have required just because of the cleft lip and cleft palate. And so it did rock their world. Now they're, he fits in so well. Like, he was meant to be here. He was meant to be here. And he does, he holds his own with the two of them. I mean, he dishes it out just as much as, you know, they dish it out. So,
so he was two when he came home.
He was 14 months.
14 months. Okay. Okay.
He was 14 months when we brought him home. So yeah. Yeah.
So do you get asked questions, as many of our families do when we're out and about? And if you do, what do you say?
Not as much anymore now that they've gotten older. My husband has been referred to as the stepdad because he's the Caucasian one.
So that's interesting. Your husband's the odd man out.
He is. So he's had college friends who will see a family picture of us for the first time and say, I didn't know you were the stepdad. And he's like, I'm not the stepdad. I am the dad. I think it's different for us only because I'm half Filipino. So the kids do tend to resemble me a little bit more with the darker hair, darker skin and eyes and everything. Lately here, we've been going through a bit of identity crisis because the kids will tell me occasionally that they're white, like their dad, and that they're not Asian. So we went through that for a while. But I have, when they were younger, I would have people who would stop. I think the girls were much of a draw because they were identical twins. And then looking at them, clearly you could tell that they were Asian. And so I got a lot of questions. I would get people who would just randomly stop me and say, wow, you know, who weren't really sure, but didn't know how to ask, and would say, wow, their dad must be really Asian. And I think one lady I had said, no, he's as white as you are. And then another woman I said one time, no, I'm the Asian one. And so, you know, that kind of stops them dead in their tracks, and they just kind of look at you like, oh, okay. So, you know, I don't know. As they've gotten older, I haven't gotten it as much. I do, now that they're in school, all three of them, they have been in the same classes, the same classroom with the same group of kids. So the girls, this will be their first, second, third year with the same group of kids. It amazes me that they're still, we don't openly go out and say, we celebrate Chinese New Year. We send stuff into school. I go in and read books for Chinese New Year. So I don't know what exactly gets back to parents. Obviously not very much, because I do have still a few parents who are shocked when they learn, like if they come over to the house and they see pictures or something and they learn that the kids are adopted, or like, what? You know, or it's easier for them to accept that Kai's adopted. And then when I say, oh yeah, the girls are adopted too. No. And I'm like, yes, they are. You know, it's not the girls. Kai seems, I just asked him not too long ago, we were talking about a friend, and he said, Mom, I told Christian that I was adopted. He asked me about it. And I said, oh, okay. And I said, did you explain it to him? And he said, yeah, I told him I'm from China. And I said, okay. And he said, but I told him not to tell anybody. And I said, well, why'd you tell him not to tell anybody? And he said, I don't know. That's kind of personal. I said, okay. And that was good enough for me, you know? And so, yeah. So I don't get it as much now.
Yeah. Is there anything that you would like people to know about the decision to adopt, about having a family that's multiracial, that is, you know, really anything about this experience that you would want to share from the road you've been on?
I think the most important thing is that we didn't start as out as a couple who went into this looking to save someone else or save these children. We went into this looking to make a family. And that's what we've done, is we've made a family. And that it doesn't matter what race or ethnicity they are. They're ours, and that's how we treat them. And so they don't, I mean, I have friends who have kids who are really struggling with the identity of being Asian and not being like everyone else. And for mine, I don't think they ever, it's all different personalities, but I don't think that it's as big of a thing to them, because we've never made it a big thing to them. If they want to talk about it, we talk about it. If they don't want to talk about it, we don't talk about it. But we give them all the information, and, you know, when they're ready, we know that they'll come back and want to discuss it with us. But we've never made it a big thing. We've always been, this is the way we ended up making our family, and that's what it's always been about.
Do you think that, generally maybe adoptive families, and I realize this is kind of a broad statement, so shoot me down if you don't think it's a reasonable question, but do you think maybe some adoptive families sort of overemphasize the differences in an effort to help their kids? Maybe it is something that would be better for all of us to just kind of chill out about.
I think for some, yes. I think that some families, I think some people may struggle with the idea that they want to make up for that cultural awareness. And so it's constantly in their face, you know, putting everything in their kids' face that this is where you're from. We don't want you to forget. For some reason, I think some people may feel like they're not doing their child justice if they're not doing that, forcing them into all of these things, and which they may think that they're doing good by their child. But I think sometimes it's good to just sit back and let them decide. You know, if you give them all the information, let them decide when they're ready, if they're ever ready. You know, my three, I think that Kai is going to be my one who's going to come back and say to me, I want to know more. My girls, I don't think they will. And I think that has more to do with the fact that they have each other. But at the same time, I think some families just need to, going back to your question, need to just kind of chill out a little bit.
Kind of let it ride.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that Kai, have any of the three of them asked about their origins very much or their biological families?
Kai has. Kai started asking a few years ago where he came from. And I think it's more of because he looks differently, because of the cleft lip, cleft palate, he wants to know more. And wanting to know why he was given up, why they didn't want to take care of him. And so I think for him, that little piece is always going to be in the back of his mind. And I really do think that he will be the one when he gets older who's going to come and say, I want to know more. I want to hear why, maybe from that person, you know, if it's possible.
Do you think that on some level he... And this may be overthinking for him. Do you think because of the surgeries, he wonders if that's a reason?
Yes. Yes, because he has asked that before.
Whether because there was something wrong
with him. He's asked because there's something wrong with him, is that the reason why they didn't want him? And so we've tried to explain to him that because they loved him so much, they knew that they couldn't give him what he needed to do all the repairs and everything. And that's the reason why he had to go live in the orphanage until we came along.
That's very touching.
Yeah. He's my kid, and he's the one who gets that, you know, but he does. There are times where he will, you know, whether it's a night when you're reading a story to him and everything, and out of the blue, he'll say, you know, mommy, do you think, you know, a mommy and a daddy, our friends, they told you that Ellie is a newborn. So when my girlfriend was pregnant, we heard a lot about, you know, is she going to come out okay? Is she going to come out like me? You know, what if something's wrong with her? Are they not going to want to take care of her? And so, you know, we've had to try to give them bits and pieces of what it's like over there and what they're capable of doing, and still reassure them that, you know, that his birth parents made a decision, that the woman who carried him made a decision, you know, that she wasn't going to be able to give him everything that he needed. And so, you know, we'll never know for sure why or if that was the reason, but we're going on the assumption that that's what it was. He came, the girls came with a birth note. He came with a birth note. And so, or a note from the birth parents. And so his note was that, you know, they weren't able to take care of him. And that they hoped that someone would be able to take him and give him what he needed. So we're going on the assumption that that's all true. And so that's what we've shared with them.
What did the girl's birth note say?
It had their time of birth. And it said that they were migrant workers and that they couldn't take care of them. And so, yeah, you know, very different situations. Girls were left at an orphanage. Akai was left in the middle of the street. So,
or at least that's what their
all their paperwork says. Yeah.
What province is Kai from?
Yunnan. So he's actually from, so he tells you he's from Kunming because that's the big city that he remembers. He's actually from what's called Daehong Prefecture, which is along the border of Myanmar and China. So, yeah, so it's a very different world down there.
Do you think you'll take the kids back?
Yes. The girls have very vivid memories of when we went to go get Kai, even at 3. They remember a lot, and that was quite an experience taking them back and people. We drew a lot of attention. but they talk a lot about, you know, the travel over there and what we got to see and everything, that Kai wants to go back. And so, and they probably get the age of 10 because we've always said to them, maybe when you're 10, that's when we'll go. We'll probably wait a little bit longer until Kai gets a little bit older. But yeah, we want to take them back. We want them to see where, we want them to tell us what they want to see, you know. So if it means that they want to go back to the orphanage, then that's where we'll go. If they just want to go back to the White Swan, well then... It's a lap of luxury for 2 weeks.
Even more so now that they've renovated.
I know, that's what I've heard.
Is there anything I haven't asked that you'd like to speak to?
I think the other thing is, too, is that this is a journey for everybody. It's just not a journey for you, your family, too. You know, where my husband comes from, you know, my family is very diverse because my mom was Filipino, my dad's Italian and German. But my husband, his family never left their little pocket of Pittsburgh. So they've always been there. So this has been a new journey for them as well, you know, to have these kids who have come from, you know, the other side of the world and, you know, everything that they've brought. And so it's not just your journey. It's your entire family's journey.
And is your husband's family into it?
They are. They I don't think they quite understood what we were doing in the beginning. You know, my mother-in-law, they never had internet or anything like that. So when we got the referral, we called and said, we have pictures, you know, we want to share them with you. And she's like, well, just tell me over the phone or mail them. And so when we told her it was twins, she could not wait to track down a friend who had the internet so she could see these pictures. And it has totally transformed their views. I mean, they came from a small area in Pittsburgh and never really saw much ethnic diversity or anything like that. And so these three have kind of rocked the world, but they're all open to it, excited about it. So, yeah.
And then last question, how much do you think your military upbringing has informed your own sense of family and diversity? How fundamental is that in the way you see this?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because we're here in Texas. We don't have any family, immediate family. It's just the five of us. And so it for me, it has made it easier because as a military family, you get up, you move all the time. And so you have to rely on those people, that group of you. So there were six of us. And that's what we had. That was our core. And so that's what we've kind of held on to with the five of us. At the same time, I think that's the reason why I'm so colorblinded by race, is because we moved around so much. I mean, my dad was stationed in Japan. We lived in Hawaii. And so we had friends and neighbors and everything of all different ethnic backgrounds. You know, the military is made up of multiracial people. And so you saw it all the time. And so it was never an issue for us. You know, you saw it and it you never thought twice about it. You know, so I think that that's something, and experiencing different cultures, you know, it gave us the ability to be able to experience those. I was able to go back to the Philippines and visit my mom's family at a young age and to see how they lived and, you know, cultural awareness. You know, my mom still, she, you know, still celebrated, you know, the way that they did in the Philippines and the food and things like that. And so you grow up around that. And so adopting kids from a different country really isn't any different. So.
And was your dad in the Army?
Marines.
Okay, great. Well, I want to thank you very much. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.